Hey folks, for this week's Labor History Today, we're picking up a show from the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, which I also produce, and where this week, labor news and labor history came together. I hope you enjoy the show. Here it is.
When do we want? When do we want
that? What was so exciting about Justice for Janitors, and I think this is key to understanding Sweeney, is he gave us the space politically, the resources. He allowed us to do things that, frankly, he was uncomfortable with us doing.
I think you're really lucky if you get one song out that people will sing when you're gone. I'm very lucky. I mean, people have always sung my songs, but I've heard Have You Been to Jail for Justice sung in Copenhagen by young kids being evicted from the youth house. I've heard it sung by a bunch of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, who were arrested in front of the White House over the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
The song has really gotten legs, and it's doing what I want it to do.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly Pod Extra. We lost two giants of the labor movement this week. Former AFL-CIO President John Sweeney and labor folk singer and activist Ann Feeney. On today's Pod Extra, we'll remember them both. In our first segment on this week's Your Rights at Work radio show, Stephen Lerner, Marilyn Schneiderman, Harold Meyerson, and Joe McCartan talked with Ed Smith and me about Sweeney's legacy as a visionary labor leader. Stephen and Marilyn both worked closely with Sweeney, Harold covered him as a journalist, and Joe, as our resident labor historian, provides the historical context for Sweeney's life and work in the movement. On that same show, Coalition of Labor Union Women President Elise Bryant told us about the free online screening by the D.C. Labor Film Fest of the new documentary 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement, coming up Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The brand new film captures the real-life fight that inspired a hit by Dolly Parton and changed the American workplace. The film is streaming online. If you're listening to this in the United States, you can watch. Get your free tickets at dclabor.org. Click on calendar. Elise also shared her memories of Ann Feeney, the labor folk singer and activist who died on Wednesday. And in our second segment, we've got an excerpt from the interview the We Do the Work radio show did with Ann recently. We'll conclude with a medley of a few of Ann Feeney's songs. You can find and order Ann's music at laborheritage.org. For the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, Pod Extra, I'm Chris Garlock. Here's the show.
Reshape our corporate priorities and put people first. We have to hold CEOs accountable and put integrity back into the companies they lead. We have to give shareholders a voice in the companies they own. And we have to clean up corporate corruption of politics through public financing of congressional election campaigns.
Welcome to Your Rights at Work. I'm Chris Garlock here with Ed Smith. That was John Sweeney, who led the AFL-CIO for 14 years from 1995 to 2009. He died on Monday at his home in Bethesda, Maryland. He was 86. With us today to talk about Sweeney's historic place in the American labor movement, I've got four guests for you. Stephen Lerner, he's an American labor and community organizer. He worked with Sweeney at SEIU to create the Justice for Janitors campaign in the mid-80s.
Marilyn Snyderman is executive director of the Center for Innovation in Worker Organization at Rutgers. Under John Sweeney, she directed the AFL-CIO's Department of Field Mobilization, where she helped launch the National Union Cities Initiative. Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large in the American Prospect. He's got a great piece on John Sweeney, the man who realigned labor. And finally, a frequent flyer here on this show, Joe McCartan. He's a labor historian at Georgetown University, where he also serves as executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor. A very warm welcome to you all. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I'm pretty sure that, like Joe Hill, John Sweeney would tell us not to mourn, but to organize. So I was hoping to make this an Irish wake in the sense that obviously we're sad to lose Brother Sweeney, but he was really an amazing and I'd say inspiring labor leader whose life and work leave us a lot to celebrate. Stephen, I thought we'd start with you. You worked with John Sweeney on one of the seminal worker campaigns of our lifetime, and I thought you could start us off and tell us a little bit about it. We could go from there.
You know, back in the mid-80s when I was a 30-something, somewhat experienced union organizer, I got hired by SEIU because Sweeney said the part of the union he came out of, the janitor's part, was dying. Subcontracting, building owners, workforce shifting to undocumented workers. And Sweeney had the vision and courage to say, everything we're doing isn't working. We need to try something new. And what was so exciting about Justice for Janitors, and I think this is key to understanding Sweeney, is he gave us the space politically, the resources. He allowed us to do things that, frankly, he was uncomfortable with us doing. Some folks may know about one of the most famous Justice for Janitors things was when we blocked all the bridges into Washington, D.C. Congress didn't meet. The Supreme Court didn't meet. We didn't truly understand the impact of all that. And the truth is, we forgot to tell John we were going to do this. And it was a little bit our relationship, which is do things, don't make him say no. And he initially was furious. But then after it worked, he embraced it. And when Donahue was running against him for AFL president and accused Sweeney of being a bridge blocker, Sweeney said, you have to block the bridges if they won't let up the fire. So he embraced it. And then if you think about the Century City strike, where, again, we were violating court orders, we were marching, we were blocking traffic, the police attacked us, 60 people were jailed, people were hospitalized, it was vicious. But initially, Sweeney said to me, I won't use the exact language, but words were involved indicating he was wondering how we ended up in a full-fledged riot. But when it came out and it became clear that the police attacked us, he not only embraced it, but it took Justice for Janitors global and all over the world, people started janitor campaigns. Well, I'll just end this little riff is Sweeney then used his enormous power and threatened to strike all of New York City.
That's right.
To get a contract in Los Angeles. And we made a breakthrough. And so the end of the story to me is we started and people said we should give up. It's impossible to organize janitors. By the end, people were saying, oh, anybody can organize janitors. They're naturally militant. And Justice for Janitors not only organized hundreds of thousands of workers, it won citywide master agreements.
So that sets up Harold, because you were, I think you were in LA at that time, weren't you?
Yes, I was the political editor of the LA Weekly. That's where I got to know Stephen, and I began to get a sense of John Sweeney that if he was, you know, hiring and not firing this creative lunatic. This was exceptional, and it really was exceptional. As Stephen noted, the one debate, formal debate at the 1995 AFL-CIO convention between Tom Donahue and John Sweeney, the really point of the clash was on the issue of that 14th Street bridge and what it symbolized for what labor needed to do if it was going to get off its back. Yes, I could see in Los Angeles the really surprising turn of labor under John Sweeney, first at SEIU, obviously. But then I think in many ways, one of Sweeney's fundamental achievements was leading the ouster of the Ancien regime at the AFL-CIO, which was still focused on the Cold War in 1985, even though the Soviet Union had ceased to exist in 1991, which struck some of us as very strange. But in the years leading up to 1995, labor had pretty much lost all of its legislative battles. So Sweeney came in, and in essence, he brought the AFL-CIO into the late 20th century. The previous regimes under George Meany and Lane Kirkland had shunned the newer social movements, the women's movement, environmentalists, people who were critical of things like Reagan's policy in Central America, which the AFL-CIO had supported. And he brought people on staff at the AFL-CIO, like Marilyn Schneiderman, who had a mandate to make some changes in Maryland. Steve Bensinger at organizing, a more focus on organizing, Steve Rosenthal in politics. So labor's political clout started to grow, but its membership didn't. And that's been the collective failure of every union for many years. And that's in many ways a function of the dysfunctional labor law. Other factors too. But in terms of realigning the labor movement and bringing it into the late 20th century and the early 21st century, I think that in many ways is John Sweeney's defining achievement at the AFL-CIO.
That actually sets Maryland up beautifully. I'd love you to talk about Union Cities and the mobilization department.
Thanks, Chris. It was life-changing to work for John Sweeney. It was about bold change and really given the space to take huge risks and to be really ambitious. You know, just as Stephen was talking about the sectoral strategy, like Sweeney knew if you want to change workers' lives, you needed to organize to change standards in a whole industry. But he also knew we needed to change this country and the communities where workers live and work. And that's where I came in with field mobilization. And the bottom line is we were really ambitious. And it actually inspired other folks to run for office to take over labor councils. And I can give example after example, but it's interesting now how many people are asking me about this work and saying, how do we get back to it? I think everything that's happened recently just demonstrates more and more why we've got to have a depth of movement in this country. It can't just be done federally and all of that. So anyway, I just feel like beyond grateful for John Sweeney, who created the space and support for this work to thrive. And it wasn't without its complications. I don't have quite the same stories as Stephen, but there were some. But it's really an opportunity to reflect on this and to learn from it and to build on it.
Thank you, Marilyn. Well, Joe, as usual, I come to you for the historical perspective. And, you know, there have not been a lot of presidents of the AFL-CIO, but he's really a unique and interesting labor leader, right?
Oh, very much so. Just consider for a moment what happened in 1995 says a lot about John Sweeney. This was a contested election for the presidency of the AFL-CIO, and it was pretty much unheard of. To have somebody who had the temerity to challenge a sitting president when Sweeney announced that he would challenge Kirkland, that really took something. And the thing about Sweeney, and this I think is touched on by the comments of Stephen, Marilyn, and Harold, is that looks could be deceiving with John Sweeney. In a lot of ways, he was a throwback to an earlier era. He came out of an AFL union as well. The SEIU was not part of the CIO. And so you would think in some ways that a person like him would not have played the role that he played, which was, as you hear from Stephen and Marilyn, really to give young people and young radicals even within the movement some space to build a big vision. And I'm really struck by that metaphor of the bridge, because like he did in Washington, as Stephen recounted, he gave them the space to block the bridge. He didn't want to know about it, maybe in the immediate aftermath and be angry, but also had their back and I think was proud of them. So he was a person who, in a sense, knew how to both build bridges and block them. And the big bridges he built, I think, are ones that you've heard referred to here. He built a bridge to the left. He built a bridge to the young. He built a bridge to immigrants. And he built bridges to women, as Marilyn pointed out. When he came into the AFL-CIO headquarters, women came and occupied key positions. People like Karen Nussbaum,
that's
for example.
Right.
Who were 95. This Irish Catholic guy from the Bronx, who in many ways resembled George Meany, really was a bridge to the 21st century in a lot of ways.
All right. That's Stephen Lerner, Marilyn Schneiderman, and Joe McCartan and Harold Meyerson talking about John Sweeney, longtime president of the AFL-CIO, who died on Monday.
Bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
That, of course, was Dolly Parton singing 9 to 5. And now there is a great new documentary out. It's called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement. We've got a free online screening next Tuesday by the DC Labor Film Fest. Here to tell us about it, our very own Elise Bryant, president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, which is co-sponsoring the film. Elise, it's so wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, I'm so excited about this. I mean, I just think that, first of all, I was conscious when 9 to 5 was forming. And I had the pleasure of meeting Karen Nussbaum way back when. And I started as a clerical. I mean, my first job sort of working in the labor movement was being at the University of Southern Bookstore in Michigan, but at the Labor Study Center. I knew what was going on. I knew what it was like to work as a clerical support person, especially in the university system. And so I totally relate to the story. And it's a story that needs to be out there because this was women really coming together and saying, hey, enough is enough. And I got fired from a job because I refused to make coffee.
why does that not surprise me?
I don't know.
The least.
I really believe this for real. Clerical support people are the backbone of any organization. You show me a highly functioning executive, and I'll show you a highly, highly functioning support staff administrative assistant. I mean, really, they take care of all the day-to-day business.
On a sad note, I didn't want to forget about Ann Feeney. And I don't know if you want to tell people about her.
Well, you know, Ann Feeney and I, met years ago at the Great Labor Arts Exchange. I'm going to guess like 85, 86, something like that. And then we had the opportunity to do this trip to Sweden together, about 15 labor activists, cultural workers. And Ann Feeney was just the talk of Stockholm. By the time we got through, I mean, just loved her. And she is a singer extraordinaire. I used to say, you know, she's the Janis Joplin of labor music. I mean, just hard rocking sister. Her song War on Workers is a classic. Everybody should listen to it. And if you want to order, you can go to laborheritage.com.org and you can order your CDs, Anthony CDs. But yeah, what an extraordinary person. And Anne always brought other artists with her. She was always looking for other artists to bring up and bring in. Of all those solo artists that came to the Arts Exchange, she probably brought more people with her than anybody else. And of course, she just lifted us. I have this story they tell, but Ann and I had a big fight and we fell out and we weren't talking for a while. And she came to me and she said, you know what, Elise, there are too few of us women in this labor movement, in this particular work, to not be friends. I'm sorry. I apologize. Please forgive me. But let's be friends. And I just like went...
You
okay, man. I'm with you, sister. And there are two women labor leaders I've shared that story with recently to say that, you know, as women, we need to come together. We can't afford to be fighting each other.
Was it Cesar Chavez? Maybe it was Dorothy Day. Some will say Dr. King or Gandhi set them on their way. No matter who you to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine. You law-abiding citizens, listen to this song. Laws were made by people, and people can be wrong. Once unions were against the law, but slavery was fine. Women were denied the vote, and children worked the mine. The more you study history, the less you can deny it. A rotten law stays on the books till folks with guts defy it. Have you been to jail for justice? I want to shake your hand, sitting in and lying down.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Your Rights at Work. And go out with a little funky version of 9 to 5. This show produced by me, engineered Kalia Chapman. Don't forget, 9 to 5 documentary next Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. Don't miss it. See y'all next week.
Welcome to We Do the Work, the voice of workers everywhere seeking economic and social justice for themselves and for their families.
We are talking today with Ann Feeney, union maid, hellraiser, cancer survivor, mother.
In the aftermath of Clinton's cruel dissolving of the welfare, ending welfare as we know it, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union went on a bus across the country interviewing women to see how their lives had been impacted by these draconian cuts to public assistance. And Kim and Reggie Harris and John Fromer and Janet Stecker and Susan Lewis and I doing an a cappella rendition of a song that the Kensington Welfare Rights Union adapted during their March for Human Rights. It was, we presented them all at the United Nations on my birthday. I remember I was in Doug Hammarskjöld Plaza singing this song with them. And this recording with Kim and Reggie is just fantastic.
Well, I went down to the rich man's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Oh, I went down to the rich man's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Now he's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. Ain't gonna let the system walk all over me. Well, I went down to the landlord's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Oh, I went down to the landlord's house and I took back what he stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity. Now he's under my feet. Under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. Ain't gonna let the system walk all over me. Well, I went down to the welfare office. I took back what they stole from me. Took back my dignity. Took back my humanity.
So I want to talk about your cancer, and it's still in remission, right?
Well, remission isn't a good word for what I'm in, because the kind of cancer I have is really kind of an automatic death sentence. Mm-hmm. And they told me when they diagnosed me on August 10th of 2010 that I might not even make it to Christmas.
Right.
And to get my affairs in order. It's going to come back. They know this. They know it's going to come back, but they don't know when. So, yeah, this is going to take me back. I say, hey, we're all going to die. I still don't know when. What's the difference? So I'm lucky that I feel so good. And my docs all look at me. They can't believe I'm still alive. Are you all right? Yeah, nothing hurts? You feel okay? They're just incredulous that I could possibly be feeling and looking as good as I do.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really surprised when I saw you up in Bellingham at that concert, how dynamic and animated and everything you were, realizing that what you had come through, and everybody there was just really thrilled that you were so healthy and so good. It was a wonderful show. Third song was School Days End.
It was a hard pick. That's a Ewan McCall piece. I don't know if you know it. It's about child labor.
Yes.
And I like School Days Over because I was really young when I did that, and I can hear my young voice.
School days over, come on and done. Time to be getting your pit boots on. On with your sark and moleskin trousers, it's time you were on your way. Time you were learning the pitman's job and earning a pitman's pay. Come on then, Jim, it's time to go. Time you were working down below. Time to be handling a pick and shovel. You start at the pit today. Time you were learning the collier's job and earning a collier's pay. Come on then, die. It's almost light. Time you were off to the anthracite. The morning mist is on the valley. It's time you were on your way. Time you were learning a miner's job and earning a miner's pay. The morning mist is on the valley. It's time you were on your way. Time you were learning the miner's job and earning a miner's pay. School days over.
What do you think your legacy is? How do you want to be remembered?
Well, I think you're really lucky if you get one song out that people will sing when you're gone. I'm very lucky. I mean, people have always sung my songs, but I've heard Have You Been to Jail for Justice sung in Copenhagen by young kids being evicted from the youth house. I've heard it sung by a bunch of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, who were arrested in front of the White House over the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
The song has really gotten legs, and it's doing what I want it to do. I didn't write this song for radio or to get famous. I wrote it so that people would have something to inspire them when they were getting arrested and going to jail, and it actually doing what I dreamed for it.
That's wonderful. Well, you certainly have a legacy to be proud of, and we are proud of you. And We're looking forward to seeing you again in the great Pacific Northwest when you get here. And keep on keeping on, Ann Feeney. And thank you for being on We Do the Work.
Thank you.
And you have a great day.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to We Do the Work. We Do the Work is a KSVR studio presentation made possible by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our thanks to the late John Fromer, original composer, and Ann Feeney for our theme song, We Do the Work, from her CD, Union Made. And remember, educate, agitate, mobilize, and organize.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1894. That was the day gold miners in Cripple Creek, Colorado, walked out on strike. Mine owners increased the workday from 8 to 10 hours. They refused to increase workers' pay accordingly. Workers immediately affiliated with the Western Federation of Miners. Local 19 leader John Calderwood demanded a return to the 8-hour day at the previous wage, but the mine owners refused. About 6 weeks into the strike, the larger gold mines imported scabs. Violence soon followed. The El Paso County Sheriff demanded the governor call out the state militia. But Colorado's governor, Davis Waite, was a populist. He recalled the troops upon learning that they would be used as strikebreakers. Soon, the mine owners raised their own private army of 100 troops, which grew to over 1,200. By May, miners had armed themselves. They took over a mine in Victor and blew it up when deputies arrived with scabs. Governor Waite ordered the owner's private army disbanded and called the militia out to defend the strikers. Mine owners agreed to return to the 8-hour workday at no loss in pay, but refused to disband their army. They arrested and beat hundreds of miners. The owners finally disbanded the forces when the governor threatened the militia's presence in Victor for a month to keep the scab army immobilized. It was the first and probably only time a state militia was called out in defense of striking workers. According to Eric Loomis, it was arguably labor's biggest win in the Gilded Age. Waite lost the next election, but the victory meant enormous organizing gains for the Western Federation of Miners throughout the Rocky Mountain region.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Here's a bonus track that was not on the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly show. Ann Feeney joined Rick Palieri and George Mann on the Almanac Trail Tour in 2013. Rick recorded this during a radio program they were doing in which they were talking about the role of music in the great wave of union organizing during the late 1930s. We'll first hear George Mann, then the show's host, then Ann Feeney.
This music comes from that time right after the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, which gave us the right to unionize. But those laws were being tested and challenged for the first few years by all the business interests. So what the Almanacs were tuning into was this mass wave of energy, and unions were organizing in steel, they were organizing in auto, they were steel in the electrical industry.
The president wants you to organize.
And the Almanacs picked up on that, and they started writing these songs and singing and popularizing them to go out to spur that movement on. That's what the 1941 tour was really about, and that's what Rick and I are hoping to do with people like Ann and others on the way around the country.
And it's incredible. I really think without the music, and Ann is a better person. I ask her to comment on this. The music was really central to this, was it not? Because in order to get everybody on board and understanding, I mean, it was a great unifier. Maybe it would have happened anyway, but it had to be a great catalyst. I mean, we think about music and unions as if they were natural bedfellows, but it didn't have to go that way, right? It could have been very different.
I think every great social movement has had a cultural component. I mean, I can't even imagine the civil rights movement without music, and the labor movement was very much the same way. If you're trying to communicate to a mass group of people with varying educational levels and varying immigration status, nothing reaches a large dissimilar group better than music. And you find yourself humming. And the IWW, one of the earliest unions in this country, was completely a musical union. Joe Hill, that they wrote the song about, was actually a fabulous union song, union songwriter. And it's the music, I think, that binds us and gets us through the tough times. And it's a way to explain very difficult concepts, too. I loved writing my corporate welfare polka, for example, because it was... It's such a complex issue, but if you make it fun, and Roy Zimmerman's a master of that, too. There are so many great people spreading the union word these days, and it's not just archival material that the tour is featuring. We're doing a lot of the music from the Almanac tour, the original Almanac singers, and from the album that emerged, or that they took with them on that tour, Talkin' Union. But it's also including a lot of newer songs that have given people hope and inspiration.
Was it Cesar Chavez? Maybe it was Dorothy Day. Some will say Dr. King or Gandhi set them on their way. No matter who your mentors are, it's pretty plain to see. If you've been to jail for justice, you're in good company.
That'll do it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, and we hope you do, please like it on your podcast app and pass it along. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. Be sure to stay tuned for a great medley of Ann Feeney's songs. You can find and order Ann's music at laborheritage.org. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.
Shake your hand. Sitting in and lying down are ways to take a stand. Have you sung a song for freedom or marched that picket line? Have you been to jail for justice? Oh, you're a friend of mine.
Say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die. Now I don't want your chemicals clouding my brain. I want to keep all of my fingers and toes. I want to hear those
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh,